Hi, good evening. I hope you had a happy new year, hope you had a good Christmas. Welcome to the York Union, our spring term events. We have a fantastic lineup for this term, but I'll speak about that at the end. Tonight it's an absolute pleasure to have Professor Danny Dorling of Oxford University, author of Inequality in 1%. He's going to be doing a short lecture about that tonight. Introducing Danny is Professor Kate Pickett, the research champion of justice inequality, and I'll let Kate take the floor. Can you give a big round of applause, please?
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here tonight to see so many of you come out on a cold, dark evening when most of us would probably rather be home watching television on the sofa. I'm always impressed when people do actually come out to hear interesting talks, so thank you for coming. It's a real pleasure to introduce Danny to you. In academic life, you have friends and you have collaborators and colleagues. They're not always the same people, but for me, Danny has been a staunch friend, a wonderful colleague, and dare I say, a comrade in arms, really. So it's a real pleasure for me to introduce him to you tonight. He's going to talk to you about inequality, injustice and the 1%, and how important inequality is as an issue politically. And it's so salient at the moment. If we look across the pond to what's going on in American politics, and if we see what is happening with Donald Trump, I think you can see the influence of inequality in politics. Money is buying influence in ways that I think we thought were gone from our democratic politics a long time ago. But that's really salient still today. If we look at what happened in Scotland around the referendum for independence, we saw inequality as a really important issue, bringing the different parties so close together. That's a really interesting phenomenon. We saw people discussing politics on the street, on buses, 16-year-olds allowed to vote, people discussing things everywhere and talking about inequality, talking about poverty, talking about deprivation in ways that have been missing from British politics for a long, long time. And with what's going on in the Labour Party this year, we see inequality taking centre stage again. I was incredibly depressed after the general election last year in May. And many people I knew were. We felt that what we had been told about what was going to happen didn't happen. We were all feeling really confused. We were all feeling really depressed. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, came the Corbyn phenomenon. And if you like it or don't like it, it's something that we need to sort of wake up and pay attention to. Young people's opinions about politics suddenly had a huge sway. Social media's influence on politics suddenly had a huge influence compared to the traditional media. And those things are really important directions in which politics might move in the future. Inequality is back on the political agenda. It wasn't there 6-7 years ago when I started writing about these issues. It's back there. We hear some rhetoric, more on the international stage than we do at the national stage, but it's there. Young people are engaging in politics in ways that they haven't for a long time and being much more influential than they used to be, and I think have more potential to be even more influential in the future than they are right now. And for academics like Danny and I who try to work on the evidence around the damage that inequality does, this is a really exciting time because people are listening, people are communicating with one another, they're sharing ideas, and you being here tonight is part of that. So I hope you'll join me in welcoming Danny to his lecture, and when he's finished talking, I'll chair some questions from the floor, and I hope you'll all get engaged in the discussion. Thanks.
Thanks, Kate, and thanks ever so much for the invite to come. You've had lectures already today, so I'm going to mainly talk and give you my opinions in a way that I can't do when I give a lecture. When I give a lecture to students in my university, I have to try to be a little bit more normal or balanced. It's not easy. What I really like about coming to something like this is I can just tell you what I honestly think is the case. I've only got one. Actually, there is a map later, so there will be one more map. But just this one for you. I'm a geographer. I'm interested in comparing different countries. I put this map up because it's a map of the world. It's a map of the world you almost certainly haven't seen before. The biggest problems of inequality are worldwide problems, but I'm only going to spend the rest of this little talk talking about the issues in rich countries. I just wanted to put up to try to stop somebody saying, why didn't you talk about the poor? Because we've only got about 40 minutes. And we live in an affluent country. I've done research on many different things. I've done research on housing, and I've done research on health, and I've done research on the 1%. By the way, who thinks that's a boring book cover? It's quite boring, isn't it? Yeah, got one. I'll show you in a minute the book cover I rejected. This is a second edition, and the point of that is that the second edition was published in September of last year. But anyway, injustice, look at Europe. If anybody wants to talk about opinions about Europe later, it is somewhat topical. We are the economically the most unequal country in Europe. Population growth, the crash, inequality in London, equality in general, and that's the cover I stupidly rejected for the book. On the grounds it was in terribly bad taste, and the book second edition was published 2 days after Piggate. But it is kind of relevant because of the way our politics works. I mean, that's a picture taken in Oxford, and our political leaders have for almost all of your lives come from Oxford. You turn up in Oxford University, and if you were quite posh, you would join the Conservative Party if you're interested in politics. If you were slightly less posh, you join the Labour Club. Biggest Labour Club in the country, Oxford University has. And the people who joined, they're my age. I could have been there, but I didn't go to Oxford when I was 18. All knew each other, became Prime Ministers, went out with each other. I thought one of the ones who went out with two of them was going to become the Labour leader. It's a tiny clique of people in this country who are at the top. We are a very, very unusual country. We think we're a normal country because that's what people do. Our frame of reference is this country. I grew up in this country, and you can easily think this is how the world is. And I think one thing we need to do is to understand how strange we are. In most of the rest of Europe, in Scotland, actually in Wales, even in the United States, you go to university relatively locally. You don't have the kind of hierarchical university system that we have in England. In almost all of the rest of Europe, almost everybody goes to state school. You don't have private schools in most European countries. We think of them as normal, but they're not. We're in a country where 7% of young people go to school, where on average 4.5 times more money is spent on their education every year than the state school child. It is a very, very unusual situation to be in. I don't know, how many of you are familiar with this kind of graph? Is this becoming general knowledge that we were a very unequal country, then we became very equal, and now we're very unequal again? Yep. It's the wrong way of asking the question. I should have asked you beforehand. Kate and I were young here in the 1970s and the 80s. Back here, the best off 1% took about 6% of all income, after tax 4%. So somebody in the best off 1% in today's money would be getting £100,000 a year on average, four times the average wage for about £25,000. Each of those dots, little squares and diamonds, is a general election. The general elections didn't matter. They didn't alter the trajectory of that curve. Of course, people thought they were terribly important at the time, but it turns out that what really matters is something that occurred around the time of the First World War. From then onwards, equality increased, and a turning point in the 1970s, and from then onwards, inequalities increased, and possibly a turning point now. Now we're at a point when the best off 1% before tax are taking about 15% of all income. The best off 10% take 28% of all income. That's a higher proportion than anywhere else in Europe. But what you're told is that this is necessary. It's needed because we need to win the global race. We need to compete. We need to reward talent. It's happening everywhere. It's about technology. It's about skills. You are highly skilled young people. You're getting into debt. Some of you, not all of you, because some of you will be having your fees paid by your parents, which is another thing we don't talk about very much. But you're getting into debt, and we're skilling you up, and you'll make the country great, and then we will reward you for all your hard work at university by paying you 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, actually an average of 10 times more than the people who are going to clean this room, probably in the morning. And that's just necessary because that's the way the world works. It's the market. And anybody who doesn't realise that is a fool. Some good news before I forget to give you some good news. The good news is UKIP. This is a picture of UKIP. Many people get very upset by UKIP. I don't get upset by UKIP because I can remember the National Front, who were really vicious in the 1970s, and I can remember the British National Party, who brilliantly this week are no longer a party because they failed to submit their accounts 6 months late. UKIP are pretty timid compared to that lot, but the reason I like UKIP is it shows we're becoming more European. All large European parties have a bunch of people with fairly Neanderthal views who do fairly well, I think as a European thing. There's a list of other things that are getting better. The gap of differentiation between men and women is getting better. 50% of young women go to university now in England. The proportion of men hovers around 40%, maybe less. So we've managed to bring in university fees at exactly the right time, so the majority will be paid off by women. That was very clever to do. Racism is certainly falling. And if you're trying to tot up things in comparisons of countries, one of the things that we are better at than most other European countries is that we are a little bit more tolerant. Not because we're innately more tolerant, just we have had longer experience of mixing with other people than people in much of the rest of Europe have. You cannot now publicly express racist views and expect to get away with it. Every leading member of the Conservative Party has to have a friend who's not white. You know, that was not the case when I was young. And I could go on and on about good news, and I think it's good to see that, to actually see that things progress and get better. The other big one, of course, a huge one in my lifetime, is sexuality. The complete and utter change from growing up as a child in a time when you really had to hide who you fancied, to then getting to a point where the government banned teachers from saying it was possible to be gay, to change now to a point where, again, nobody can expect to have a serious career in politics if they express bigoted views. They still have them. Many people still have those views, but they've learnt to keep them quiet. But things that are going badly wrong. We are rapidly heading back 100 years towards a private rented society with landlords. In London, the proportion of people renting privately is going up by more than 1% each year. We now have 250,000 children in London living in private rented houses, on average having to move home every 2 or 3 years. This is going to destroy all the achievements of inner London schools, because you cannot move school and lose all your friends again and again and do well at school. It was a reaction to the crisis. It wasn't planned. If you were wanting to make the country a country with a few landlords and many renters, you'd have done it in a more subtle way, and you wouldn't have done it in a way which has affected so many families. A quarter of families with children in England are now renting privately with short-term tenancy agreements. If you just try and think about what the insecurity of that feels like, and what happens in the south of England is that you constantly get outbid, because if you've got kids, you've got slightly less disposable income as compared to young professionals without children. So landlords see what they can get in rents from other people, and they raise the rent, and you have to move further away from the middle of the city so that a couple of young professionals can move into the flat in which you are living in. But this doesn't just hurt people who are poor, it's going to hurt you. Because those of you who are very successful, those of you who get good 2-1s or get first and somebody picks you up and gives you a job in London, which is where probably at least a third of you are going to be in a few years' time, you're going to be paying most of your income from that job in rent. You're going to be renting a room in a house which may well not have a sitting room, because they've worked out that they can actually rent out the sitting room as well to yet another young professional. And then eventually you'll get into your mid and late 30s, and then there's only one thing will matter. It won't be how hard you've worked. It won't even be whether you've been slightly Machiavellian and nasty at work and stamped on other people to get your way up to the top. The thing that's going to matter for you, if things carry on like this, of your career, if you do go south, is whether you have any inherited wealth. That'll determine whether you can stay in a career in London or not. And people tend to get quite angry about that. The idea that we're returning to a time when the wealth of your family is going to determine your future and what kind of jobs you can do and where you can be. This certainly affects the city I live in now in Oxford. If people apply to the university I work in for jobs to be a lecturer, what really determines whether they can be a lecturer is whether they've got money to help them be able to buy a house, because the prices of houses are now so high. We have a rhetoric, though, that none of this really matters. It's just yet more competition. And the people whose family have these monies, where they must have worked hard in the past or been 50 and saved, if you try hard enough, you too can be 50 and saving. Maybe it won't be you, but if you try a bit harder a long way away from London, your children could get into that group in London because you can save up money and make it possible for them. You get quotes. Kate mentioned Donald Trump. Donald Trump famously said he started off with only a million. You know, so it's a rags to riches story, because a million for somebody like Trump is rags. And this is endlessly repeated with these people who've supposedly come from nowhere. Nowhere is a million. The tadpole philosophy. The tadpole philosophy was christened in the 1930s by a man called R.H. Tawney. Tawney wrote a book on equality, and this was at the time when we were beginning to become more equal. The tadpole philosophy is that I stand up here on a rock, you're all little tadpoles. I stand on the rock, I'm a big fat frog, and I tell you, little tadpoles, if you just copy me, you do what I did, you too can be on this rock. Grow your legs, climb up. It's a competition, but it's fine, you'll all make it. If you've ever looked at tadpoles in a pond, you'll realise that the vast majority of them die. They cannot all get on to the rock. But if you can keep people thinking the rhetoric of competition is fine, you can do it for individuals, but you can also do it for cities. We need to have Sheffield competing with Leeds, competing with Barnsley, competing with Manchester. We can have a northern powerhouse, and that'll all be fine, but just don't look at the overall picture. Work harder. Market yourself, sell yourself, and you'll be okay. And don't look at the divides that are widening all the time. Most complicated graph, but I do like data. The red areas on this graph are where a majority of people are renting. It goes from 1983 to 2012, and along the y-axis, for anybody who's particularly nerdy, this is for you, is age. That's 18-year-olds going right down to 90. This group here are the elderly who were majority renting. Council houses and older private renting
which is disappearing, and they that old group have gone. This green group in the middle are the one generation who could get a mortgage and buy, and this new red group, which is getting redder to these ages rapidly, are the new renters.
In the south of England, for a property in an affluent area, the rent is twice a mortgage. So it's not just that you're paying rent to somebody, but you're actually paying twice as much as somebody who can have a mortgage can pay. And the worry is that we are returning to what we had left. So here's the rhetoric. Don't worry about your debts. As long as you work hard enough, you'll be okay. And the problem is, it just doesn't stand up to scrutiny. If you put it most simply, only 1% of people can be in the 1%. And since 2008, only the 1% have seen their incomes grow. They've actually fallen for everybody else. Only the 1%, to be in the 1%, you need an income of 160,000. Only the 1% can get a mortgage on an average house in somewhere like Fulham now, a free bed. So if you want to have some form of stability, you're told you have to aim to be in that group. I did an interview with the Telegraph newspaper about a year ago, all about the problem of inequality in the 1%, and the young man who wrote it up turned it all into advice about how to get into the 1%, what you need to do. So I've got news for you. I'm afraid those of you who are not studying law or are not studying business studies and economics, your chances are pretty low. And I'm afraid if you're not studying law or business economics in particular universities, your chances are very low. A little bit more data about how unusual things have got. This is a graph which was drawn by Becky Tunstall, who's based in this university. Just worry about the top line. The top line is the ratio of the number of rooms that the best off tenth in society have compared to the worst off tenth. It's rooms per person. So way back in 1911, this is the time of Downton Abbey and servants and so on, and people living in slums and in squalor. The best off tenth had four times more rooms per person on average than the poorest tenth. What that meant in 1911 was that the poorest families were living four to a room and the best off one to a room. That inequality increases to 1921 as income inequality and wealth inequality also was increasing then, and then it fell and fell and fell and fell to the happy socialist heights of 1980 and a 3-to-1 inequality. So it's not that we were incredibly equal in the 1970s and early 1980s, it's just that we became a little bit less unequal, which meant that we were much better distributed amongst our housing stock. So to get into a maisonette, you had to have a family and you had to have a need to get into a two-bed maisonette. Things were allocated a bit more fairly. Now you get into that maisonette if you can pay the rent. So you suddenly end up with just one person in the maisonette and no children in these former council estates where there are signs up saying no ball games. The incredible thing is the change that's been since 1991. And you see it just going up and up. A little bit of that is ageing, but most of that is the effects of growing inequality. So a small group of people getting more and more and actually getting quite lonely in large houses, and a large group of people becoming more and more crowded and finding the cost very high. And it's not that we don't have enough houses. We've actually got more bedrooms per person in the country than we've ever had. It's mainly the inequality and distribution. Jump from average people to the very top. Because before you start feeling too aggrieved about the 1%, one important thing to understand is that there is more inequality within the 1% than there is in the other 99% of society. Since 2008, inequality within the 99% has fallen. It's actually gone back to 1992 levels, when John Major was Prime Minister. So you could say and David Cameron has said this, that equality has risen. He says it by ignoring the 1%. As soon as you put the 1% in, inequality has risen. The entry level for the 1%, as I said, is 160,000. But if you go out to Enfield in North London, a three-bed house out in Enfield will cost you £1 million. Imagine you have got that £160,000 a year job, and you've got a partner and they've got a normal job, a very well paid job at £40,000. So you've got a joint income of £200,000. You cannot get a mortgage for a three-bed house at the far end of the Piccadilly line in London, and you're in the 1%. You need to be on about £300,000, which is the average for the 1%. And that's very hard to get to. This is just to buy yourself a house. Now, you might think the people on £300,000 a year think they're very well off, but when we actually ask people in this bracket, they don't. And they don't because they can see the people above them. What most people are doing at the bottom of the 1% is actually working for people in the 0.1%. They're lawyers for people who are better off than them. They're moving the money around on behalf of people who are better off than them. And the people in the 0.1%, and now you're heading towards an income, you know, a bit under about £1 million, they don't think they're that well off because they read the Sunday Times. And every Easter, the Sunday Times produces the rich list. And the rich list tells you what you need to get into the 1,000 richest families in the country. You need about £100 million of wealth now to get into the rich list. The Queen used to be number 5 and now she's way down. I don't know, number 80 or 90. The rich list can easily make you feel very normal if you are very, very well off. And I'm not being facetious here. People on these incredibly high incomes do not feel well off. It's such a waste of money, if you like. If it was making them happy, it would make a bit more sense, but it isn't. I was talking to a couple of elderly, pretty well-off people in London, again, a couple of years ago, and was giving them these statistics. And the wife said, oh, that can't be right. It can't be 160,000 because that means our children are in the 1% and we're having to help them get a house. And if you've got people at the top of society saying that, I think you've got some idea of how wrong things are going. The people in the Sunday Times Rich List, since 2008, have doubled their wealth. Absolute doubling. So you'd think that they were sitting there going, this is great, this is wonderful. But if you are in a rich list, this is London. It doesn't look like London, but it is a little map of London. Half of the richest 1,000 people live in London. But those 10 families have a quarter of all the wealth of the 500. So you're stuck, if you like, between them if you're in the bottom part of the rich list. This is what the national distribution looks like of where super wealth is. And where we're heading is towards a country which is a safe haven for the very, very wealthy of the world. So by various estimates, and it's very hard to pin down where the billionaires really are and where they live, but we may well have the highest proportion of billionaires per head. We certainly have the lowest property taxation in the rich world. Plan A is to be a safe haven, a place where the very, very rich want to come and be, and to benefit from the trickle-down of their wealth. Camelot produced a report a few years ago showing that the average lottery winner creates 6 jobs, including a personal beautician. So there are jobs that you could do. Now, I have a friend whose daughter is doing a master's degree in German and fine art so that she can work as an art dealer to help members of the super rich purchase for their portfolios. She's just 21, 22 years old and has worked out this is a sensible route forward. We are strange. The United States is stranger, and that's the only reason that we don't think we're strange. All rich countries were very unequal 100 years ago. This is just a selection of six that I didn't pick. We can do a much bigger one. They all became rapidly more equal. And the reasons are interesting. There are many reasons, one of which was probably that little revolution in Russia, because it did kind of scare people at the top of society. But the cost of paying for wars was important as well. Wars cost a lot of money. Only the rich had money. You had to tax them to pay for the wars. All very similar, all come down. The United Kingdom here was the second most equal large country in Europe apart from Sweden. That's my childhood. And I can go on endlessly about what the world was like then. It was not bad, I think, although people had maligned the 1970s. And then we did this strange thing. We jumped over country after country after country to become the most unequal country. And it's interesting to work out why did we do that. It certainly wasn't inevitable. When somebody tells you inequality has risen everywhere, you've only got to look at the spread of distribution to see that that didn't actually happen everywhere. The Netherlands, the best off 1% have 6.7% of all income. In Switzerland, the best off 1% have half what the best off 1% have in our country. And the Swiss have bankers. They just pay their bankers half as much. The European Union surveys the incomes of bankers. We try to stop them doing it. So the European Union produces statistics every year about how many bankers are paid over €1 million a year. In this country, it's something like 2,200 are paid over €1 million a year. The next highest number in the whole of Europe is Germany, and it's 197. Right, that's how strange we are. There are more people paid over €1 million or the equivalent a year in Barclays headquarters in Canary Wharf than in the whole of Japan. Now you may think this is necessary to run Barclays. There's something very strange about Barclays, where Barclays can only possibly work by paying that many people that highly. Often people say if you were to do something to reduce the income of our 2,200 bankers, they'd move overseas somewhere else. There is nowhere for them to go. Nobody else is paying those kind of salaries in Europe. They'd have to take a pay cut of half to go for a job in Switzerland. They could, of course, and this is part of the reason why we have these high salaries, they could try to get a job in New York, which is the only other place that pays as much. But it might just be the case that the Americans want to hold on to their jobs and really wouldn't want a load of Brits suddenly turning up. Here's the International League table. This data is about 5 years old. I will very quickly show you the more recent data. This is the ratio of income of households, the best off tenth of households to the worst off tenth, the most equal country in the rich world. These are the 25 richest countries on the planet with at least 2 million people, with Japan. Then the Scandinavian countries, Finland, Norway, Sweden. And then Germany. Very, very productive company. Austria, Slovenia, South Korea, Denmark, Belgium. And there's Switzerland, which is kind of heading in the middle by that measure. Then we go up. France, Netherlands, Ireland, Canada, Greece, Spain, Italy, New Zealand, Australia, and then Israel. Right? Israel is a very unequal country. This is everybody living in what is legally Israel. And there we are above Israel. Now, we think of ourselves as normal. We don't think of ourselves as living in a country that is more divided by money than Israel is, but we do. That's what we are in. Above us was Portugal. Portugal's now moved down with the crisis. The rich lost their money in Portugal because housing prices in Lisbon halved. The United States is still more unequal than us, but we're narrowing the gap with them. And Singapore is a really interesting place to look if you want to know what an even more unequal society will look like. Although Singapore brought in capital controls after 2008 to stop people buying flats and leaving them empty in Singapore. So they came to London to buy flats and leave them empty instead. Singapore and the US are addressing this better. This is more recent data, just to show that the thing still continues. And there's lots of small print for anybody who worries about data. People like me and Kate are constantly attacked about our data by people who just don't like the idea. So what you do, if you don't like the idea that inequality might be a bad thing, you go for the people's data rather than actually worry about the idea. Since the crash, it has been interesting what's happened. A series of oil countries have jumped into that top 25. They probably jumped out of it in the last 12 months, given the price of oil. But we can talk about that later if you want. This cartoon appeared in 1936. It's a cartoon that's been endlessly shown again. You can replicate the cartoon today simply by adding two noughts to the salaries, putting two women in rather than just having men. And the difficult thing is working out how you replace the hats with something else. But the big difference today, they were all stepping down in the 1930s. The point of the cartoon was to say it's all stepping down is okay, but if you're at the bottom, you're going to drown. The difference today is that the person at the top is actually stepping up while everybody else has stepped down. And that's very different. You can see I'm going through these faster than normal because I was going to give you this horrible slide. But this horrible slide really, really matters. George Osborne, in the budget, said many things which were interesting. The really interesting things are the ad-lib. He had a lovely ad-lib at the end where he talked about the Party for Working People. I had memorised the quote at some time, but I won't malign it. But he also said that UK is only home to 1% of the world's population but spends 6% of the world's welfare bill. We are a high-taxing, high-spending country. I honestly believe that George believes that. I do. George and his 11 spads, I think, all believe that to be true. I don't think they sit there going, it's complete rubbish, but we'll just feed it to the British public anyway. I do think they believe it. This data comes from a subversive organisation called the International Monetary Fund. It's the proportion of public spending of GDP each year in all these countries. The shocking thing is Ireland. Ireland had to spend 64% of its GDP one year because they followed our advice about guaranteeing every single deposit in the banks. George Osborne's family come from Ireland and we gave them special loans to do that. But the one you need to be looking at is that's our public spending. This is a high taxing, high spending country apparently. And you can see the range of possibilities. If somebody tells you it has to be like this if we're going to win the global race, everybody's doing it, there is no choice, it's about skill, talent and technology, my economics degree tells me so, right? Somehow, the weird religion of economics means that they are impervious to simple data. This has no effect on them. You know, this. When I first showed these slides, which wasn't very long ago, I showed them down in a public meeting in Dorchester in the south of England. And I got an email from somebody who writes for UKIP Weekly. And I thought, if you want some fun, I never knew UKIP Weekly existed. And he said, your data must be wrong because we're a high tax and spending country. So I sent him the data and I said, look, it's the IMF, please tell me where it's wrong. And then he didn't reply. And I think this is part of our problem. I won't go through all the possibilities, but you can tax and spend over 50% of your GDP and live in a very nice place and have very good schools. In Switzerland, they spend twice as much per head on healthcare than we do. They spend about 40% more in Germany, spend about 30% more in France. We have a very good NHS, but we're funding it on one of the lowest levels in the whole of Europe. And we're funding it on one of the lowest levels in the whole of Europe because we are taxing and spending so little. We also spend more on arms than other countries, which doesn't particularly help. Oh, naughty Labour Party. So do you remember that stuff about not fixing the, you know, roof when the sun's shining? Here's the rise of the spending under Labour. Okay? The one that they said they shouldn't have done, the one that Ed Miliband was supposed to apologise for. That's what it is. It was very, very, very naughty. It really was, because that is actually the cost of that war. Right? If you take out the cost, if we hadn't gone to war, that war which has had such a wonderful effect on stability in the Middle East.
But that is,
if you take out the war, we wouldn't have had a rise in wasteful spending. All countries had to increase their spending to cope with the crash, but the scope of possibility has actually widened in how they've chosen to deal with it. It's not narrowed down. Why do we have high rates of inequality historically? Japan is the most equal country in the rich world because it lost a war. It was the most unequal country in the 1920s and 30s. It was feudal. It had an aristocracy. Right? People were peasants on the land still. When Japan lost the Second World War, the Americans moved in, and as a brilliant natural experiment, they took the land and redistributed it as evenly as they possibly could amongst the population. The Americans didn't do this because they had a great belief in equality. They did it because they were rightly terrified that there would be a revolution in Japan. And the result was to move Japan from a country of one of the lowest life expectancies in the rich world, 80 years later, well, less than 80 years later, to have one of the highest lives. Things improved in Japan. Winning a war allows you to stay unequal because the people at the top stay at the top. Losing a war is one way to become more equal. Germany is much more equal because it lost a war. There are people who argue for inequality. Hopefully somebody will be brave enough to do this later. I promise not to be completely mean, and it would be more interesting if somebody would to do it. There are people who argue, and at particular times this has really mattered. The people who argued for greater inequality in the 1970s won. This is Margaret Thatcher, Keith Joseph, and anybody know about the tall poppies? You shouldn't cut off the tall poppies, you should allow tall poppies to grow tall, and then the whole of society will benefit. It was a plausible argument in the 1970s. When Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister, she signed up to the WHO goals on health inequalities, committing Britain to halve health inequalities within a generation by the year 2000. Because she believed that allowing economic inequality to widen would be for the good of all in society, would make us better off and healthier and happier. In fact, our health inequalities doubled rather than halved. But she couldn't have known. My argument is that now we should know. I blame my parents. If people had known in the 1970s just what was at stake, I think they would have tried a little bit harder. They did try harder in most countries in mainland Europe. Whereas in the US and the UK, we got politicians who wanted inequality to rise. There are particular times when it really matters to be politically active. Now might be one of those times. The 1970s was one of those times. Other differences matter. The United States can only have the incredibly high levels of inequality it has because of racism. You have to see people as different to put up with these kind of differences. We have class differences in this country, which again we don't see very well because they're just ours, but they were there to be rekindled in the 1970s and 80s. Margaret Thatcher was painted as a grocer's daughter. It's a very clever painting. She was born into the top 10%. By the time she was 11, her father owned two shops in Grantham, putting him in the top 1%. He was also the alderman of the city. And she went to grammar school. When she turned up at Oxford, she was in the 1%. Oxford and Cambridge take 1% of all children. When she married Dennis, she was in the 0.1%. She then becomes Prime Minister and is presented as a grocer's daughter in the 0.1%. She died, poor lady, stumbling around the corridors in the Ritz Hotel, not knowing where she was. But it's an amazing way we've told a story about somebody which simply doesn't fit who they were. Israel and Singapore, there are obviously deep divides. In Singapore it's between Chinese and Malay. In most of the rest of the world, inequality is due to poverty. Most countries in the world are far more unequal than these rich countries. Inequality is actually, it's normally a sign of great poverty. So only a few places, Kerala, Cuba, Costa Rica, in the rest of the world, which are not that unequal. But finally, I think inequality is allowed to be this high because people don't think it matters that much. They don't know what the consequences are. So I'm going to end just going through some of the consequences with you and then open up. there are a whole set of vague correlations which are interesting but vague, but really interesting. And these are not causal. It is not that people in the United States wake up, check the inequality ratio, and then go, I'm going to have a burger. That is not how things work. But in the United States, 4% of GDP is spent on advertising. Here it's about 2%, in mainland Europe it's about 1%. Advertising is about getting you to buy things that you don't want to have. It's not necessarily a beneficial thing. We eat about 50% of the meat. Japan's really low. Is it correlated? You might think, well, this makes no sense. How can it be correlated? The much stronger graph, and Kate's done this a bit, is obesity. If I go to the United States, I'm positively svelte. Right? I don't look that fit. If I go to China, to Japan, and I spend a week in Kyoto, I don't meet anybody as fat as I am. Right? Rates of obesity correlate these. There are always exceptions. There's a good reason why New Zealand eats more meat. A few years ago, it was Denmark. Carbon dioxide emissions. Again, it's a weak one, but it's interesting. More unequal countries tend to rely on cars more. More equal countries are much better at arranging public transport systems. There's gasoline. And yes, the United States is driving this, but if you were to take the 50 states of the United States, then you'd get 50 little dots there. Infant mortality rate's a bit stronger because it reacts quite fast to social circumstances. These rates are incredibly low. These are historically low rates of infant mortality, but you're still looking at twice as many grieving parents in the United States than in normal affluent countries. And we have the worst child health in Europe. 6,000 children die a year. We have the highest rate. A study done comparing the health of our children to the health of children in Sweden found that from over 20 different forms of death, children in Sweden are less likely to die than our children are. There are loads of other effects that have been shown to be related to inequality. Levels of trust reduce in more unequal countries. I think the reasons are obvious why. You can do tests where you ask people whether they would ask somebody else to look after their bags on a train, those kind of things. In fact, you can almost always trust somebody to look after your bags on a train, but in unequal countries we're more likely not to. The more fun tests of this kind are the ones that ask people if they're good drivers. And what you're doing is trying to find out. You ask people, are you better than an average driver? Almost everywhere in the world, over 50% of people will tell you they're better than an average driver. But in more unequal countries, a much, much higher proportion will. Well, are you better looking than average and so on? You have to talk yourself up when you're living in an unequal society. People don't understand the society that they're living in as well in unequal countries because they're segregated, so they don't know about the lives of others because they don't mix as well. I'm going to show you in a minute to learn less well and compete more. That fascinates me. Exam results become really important for obvious reasons. You're young adults entering the world of work in a country where the best off 10th of families, and most of you will probably be in or just below the best off 10th, will have an income 10 times higher than the worst off 10th. So it's really mattered to do well at school. It really mattered to go to university. It wasn't really an option for most of you to go, oh, I'll just hang around at home and I'll take a job working in a shop. That'll be fine. Right? The incentive to do something different was very high because you found it hard to contemplate what life would be like if you weren't here. And then you're going to worry about what degree result you're going to get. You're going to worry about getting that job. You're going to be worried about getting that promotion because it matters. The differences between you are going to grow. If we could bring you back all here in 20 years' time and we'd go from the highest salary here to the lowest salary here, there'll be a wide span among you of how much you're getting. And that's because you're in Britain. And if you're in another country in the rich world, there wouldn't be that kind of difference. So people don't become teachers and they don't become nurses because they can't imagine living on the salaries of teachers and nurses. We have 250,000 accountants. I think we've got more trained accountants than anywhere else. Well, I think think the statistic I read said more than the whole of Europe put together. But we train 250,000 accountants. We only train 50,000 doctors. It's a very odd thing to do. Okay, let's take maths ability. Right, I need a little bit of audience participation. Brave, who got a seal below at GCSE? Great, got some. Well done, Kate. Who got a B or below? Who got an A? Who got an A star? Right. Now, all you A stars, okay. Let's think. And I won't be mean, and we'll do a test on the A stars. This is OECD data from Teston in 2012 of a random sample of 15-year-olds and their ability at maths to do a same maths test. Maths is nice because it's similar, you know, between countries. So, you know, it's not like testing literacy where it's a bit harder in Finland because of the language. And what you see is the United States, the United Kingdom don't do that well on maths. These countries up here, particularly Japan, Singapore's a bit annoying. We're doing better at maths. I mean, you can actually take anybody. Eton has shown how to do this. You can take anybody, and if you train them enough, you can get them an A. I think probably an A star. But anyway, we don't do that well at maths, and we're more an equal country. But the shocking thing is this. This is that same maths test, or a very similar maths test, undertaken in 2012 of people aged 16 to 24. And the United States is well down there. Here's the United Kingdom. Now, I've shown you a whole load of scatter plots, and you see some of them are a bit dodgy. This one's much less dodgy. So what's going on? What I think is going on, and we've only had this data for a few years, what I think we do in the US and UK is we work really, really hard to teach you how to get an A star that day. We don't teach you to enjoy maths. In fact, we may well have put you off maths by how important it was for you to do well in maths. But we teach people to get very high exam results on particular days, because those exam results will be used to sort them out later. And then you get to university, as long as you're not stupid enough to go and do maths at university, the maths we've taught you, which actually wasn't very good, is enough to let you just get by and do your politics or economics degree, whatever. And we don't know it's not good, because we think we're good at maths because somebody gave us an A star. So you must be good. I have a relative, I've got to be careful what I say, a relative who was a young child, told me he was really good at maths, he got 98%. And my mum asked him what 98% mean. He said, I don't know, but I got 98%. Haven't got the idea of percentages. Right. This is scary, I think. You know, as an effect, if in our competitive environment, because it really matters where you get to, we are actually teaching very, very badly, because exams are so important, it matters. Last graph, just about how different things can be. Almost last, there's one more, but it's political, so I hope you like that. This is showing the proportion of people who walk or cycle to work. In the United States, it's 3.5%. In the Netherlands, it's around about 50%. It's a bit low in Japan because the train system's so good. Japan has had a declining proportion of cars for the last 20 years. I'm just trying to show you the enormous variety of how different things can be in different places. The idea that you have to behave in the same way everywhere. The geographical data says it isn't the case. And it isn't because the United States is a large land area. It's ideological. A thing I quote far too much is a mayor of a small town in Texas who opposed the introduction of pavements in the town. Many parts of the United States don't have pavements. And when asked why they opposed the introduction of pavements, they said because pavements are the beginning of the road to socialism. And you can find many more examples like this in the United States. What really worries me about it is, and they're obvious, and apologies to people from the States who are here, I suspect quite polite people in mainland Europe, and certainly in Japan, laugh at us in a very similar way because of things that we do. But as countries become more equal, people become actually more polite and less self-pushing themselves forward. So they don't say. People from more equal countries don't go out saying how wonderful the more equal country is, partly because more equal countries do not produce egotistical people like Donald Trump, who are very happy standing in front of a lot of people and promoting themselves. Whereas more unequal countries, that's the kind of atmosphere that we've grown up to have. Political graph. You might notice this looks very similar to the inequality graph of how much the 1% take. And I think it has to be related. This is just a segregation index. He says, just a segregation. What it is, it's the proportion of Tory voters you'd have to move between constituencies at each general election to get an even distribution. So I imagine I've got a magic political butter knife, and I'm spreading my magic political butter knife across the country, and it's going to move Conservative voters from Surrey and put some of them into South Yorkshire, because South Yorkshire doesn't have enough and Surrey has too many, to get an absolutely even distribution. So it's not about who wins or loses the election, it's about the concentration of votes. And I've done it on the Conservative Party because they're the party that has been around for this whole time. It was very unequal. There were divides between Protestant and Catholic parts of the Northwest. The Protestant part would be Tory, the Catholic part would be Labour or Liberal. The Conservative vote became very evenly distributed in the country. You could find Tories everywhere, but nowhere would there be a great concentration of Tories, which is not necessarily good for winning an election. And then we had a little event in 1974. There were two other elections in 74, February and October. In October 1974, the southeast of England swung to the Tories. Not enough to win them the election. The election was won by Labour. But if you look at it historically, that may have been the seminal event. And it was voters. This was a year before Margaret Thatcher was made in the way they used to do it, leader of the Conservative Party. Little revert back down to 79, and then this relentless increase in the polarisation of the votes. And then this amazing thing in 2015, and it's staggering. It has nothing to do with Scotland, because there were hardly any Conservative voters left in Scotland by then. So that jump in polarisation happened in England. Tory areas became more Tory. You think, well, how on earth did they win the election? It's partly because a whole set of Tory areas were actually voting Liberal before. The Labour vote rose in London. The Labour vote rose in Sheffield. The Labour vote rose in Oxford East, where I live now. Oxford East is about 50%. It's like a double pit village in Oxford East. But it's a complete waste of time getting more votes for Labour in Oxford East, because it already holds the seat. So we've reached a high point. It's actually surpassed the Kharki 1918 election. It's the highest segregation of Conservative voting ever. The first we can measure is probably about 1832. So we're living in a very, very strange political time. And what it means practically is that now you have clusters of people voting in particular ways and thinking in particular ways. If I go 10 to 15 miles, less than that, out of Oxford East and pick somebody at random, they will most likely vote Conservative. They might toy occasionally with voting Liberal. Inside Oxford East, they don't vote, or they vote Labour. There's a few Greens, but not very many. And that polarisation between different people living in different areas has risen, which means we don't share ideas with each other. We become a more divided country in how we think, and we don't understand each other. So a media based in London can call an election wrong, because if people in the country had voted like they voted in London, it would have been a very different election. This is data that ONS released by mistake, that George Monbiot then put up on the web. ONS then retracted the data. It's about the wealth distribution of Britain. They retracted the data because they think the estimate of the wealth for the top 1% is an underestimate, but they can't be sure. That is a cartoon that used to be drawn in the 1970s and 80s about how terrible wealth inequality was. And it's just got much, much wider. Honestly, if you're thinking you can play a game where somehow you're going to manage to get there, you're a fool, I think. in the past, I've talked too long, so I won't go on. I think we've reached the end of an experiment. I think you could honestly have said, logically in the 1970s, it is theoretically possible that if you free people up to compete, things will get better for everybody as a result of that competition. I think you could have honestly held those views in the 70s and have thought that terrible things were happening to the country because competition wasn't being allowed to happen, but in fact terrible things were happening to the country because we had been the most powerful place in the world and we were slowly becoming a normal country. But you didn't like that. You wanted to win the global race. Your dad had been a stockbroker, a very successful stockbroker. Your family had owned plantations in the Caribbean. And all you could get was a job working for Carlton TV for £90,000 when you came out of Oxford with your first in PPE. And there was that lovely woman, Margaret Thatcher, who you adored. And you were a teenager, and she was wonderful. And you didn't just adore her. Your friend George adored her. He changed his name from Gideon. And your friend Teresa, who was studying geography in Oxford, adored her. And your friend Boris, who was also an adorer. And she was speaking sense. She was speaking to you. You wanted to be great again. And then you had the ignominy of that Tony Blair goes and wins that election in 1997. And you're out of power all the way through to 2010. And then in 2010, you get a bit of power, but you've got those really annoying liberals sitting there all the time stopping you, doing what you know is right, what you know is good, what you know will make Britain great again, because that's what drives you on. You've got fire in your belly. And then finally, unexpectedly, somehow, 25% of the electorate vote for you in May 2015, and it's yours. And all those things you know that were true all along, you can finally enact them. And you can make the country wonderful and great. And by 2020, nobody will recognise the place and it'll be a massive success. And they'll make statues of you and put them up. I think that is what the thinking is. And what worries me is we then have a theory of trickle-down in one country. Trickle-down can't work everywhere. But one country could get the rich in, couldn't it? One place could have the lowest property taxes in the world so that people buy homes in London and near London and maybe occasionally in York. And that's a good thing. Anybody who says high property prices are bad doesn't know how the market works. It's good. You want them to go up. These people will create jobs. They're wealth creators, magicians, magic people who can make wealth. And this is a future for us. We could even open up our universities and take in the children of the world's rich and charge them fees of £15,000 or £20,000 or £25,000 or £30,000 a year. And that's an export industry. It's a big export industry. For 10 years I worked in the University of Sheffield, and by the time I left Sheffield 3 years ago, the income that Sheffield Hallam and Sheffield University were bringing in from overseas students, 25% of their intake 3 years ago, was a greater profit than the entire metal industry of South Yorkshire, just from the overseas students. And the metal industry of South Yorkshire is largely an arms industry and still quite successful. So it's trickle-down in one country. The problem with trickle-down in one country is what's going to happen to you in that particular scenario. Are you going to become a teacher and come down and teach in my town? Because the salary will allow you to rent a room. That's all it'll let you do. What happens if you want to have a child? What happens if you want to start a family? What are you going to do? And that's why we need to be angry about the point we've got to. Because it's no longer benefiting the best off 10% of society, which is what happened in the past. It's only benefiting the best off 1% of society, and even then it matters where you are in that best off 1%. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you. much, Danny. I always feel that listening to you is a bit like reading an encyclopedia. Your knowledge is so broad, but it's your passion that interests me the most. You've given us a lot to think about. I'm going to take questions from the audience, and I think we're going to go until about 5 to 8. So if you're keen to speak, please raise your hands. And should we take in groups of 3? Is that all right?
Two. Memory's not good.
All right, memory. Okay. 1 and 2. Thanks.
So what do we do about it?
I'll take us to 5 to 8.
Similar one. Okay. Recognising it as a problem. There are a group of people who do not think it's a problem. So actually, recognising it as a problem is the most important thing. That includes telling other people you think it is a problem, especially people who don't agree with you. It's very easy for me and Kate to agree with each other ever so much and be very, very happy. It is much more painful and difficult to tell other people. My favourite example of somebody who did this, I was asked to talk to a group of board-level bank members about inequality, who were very, very highly paid. And halfway through talking to them, I asked them, why have you invited me here? And one of them said, because my son stopped talking to me at Christmas because he decided I was part of the problem. So, okay, that's not talking, but it was effective. I honestly think that is half the battle. It's what occurred in the 1920s and 30s. The moral sentiment of the country changed. Oswald Foulkes, who was a banker and a friend of John Maynard Keynes, said what Keynes had really done is helped change the moral sentiment. So it became to be seen as wrong to agree with such inequality. Then what there is to do politically, there's a lot you can do. As you can probably guess, I quite like Corbyn. I'm the right agent to like him. But the point about the long shift is, what happens is all political parties move together. They've all moved to the right since the 1970s. Ed Miliband's policies were actually to the right of Margaret Thatcher's. And things he agreed with, she actually was doing things that were, she taxed at a much higher level. Part of what's happening in the Labour Party at the moment is a shift to the left, just to becoming a normal left-wing mass party in Europe. But it also helps move the Liberals towards the left, which nobody is noticing that they're moving under Tim Fallon. And what you really want to begin to see is Tory stepping towards the left, it being okay to be a bit less bloodthirsty as a Conservative, a bit nicer, a little bit more one nation again. You want to see a rise of a Green Party. It's normal to have a Green Party. Ours is too small. So I'm not saying you have to go for any one particular party. In fact, if you're really brave, really dedicated, almost no matter what your politics are, join a Conservative Party and help them move. But that's hard work. But it's getting involved and moving it that does matter. And also saying, when your university hires a new Vice-Chancellor and pays them so much, at our university, the student activists turned up every 12 days to wherever the Vice-Chancellor was to celebrate the fact that he was being paid yet again the salary of an average worker in university. Unfortunately, he then removed the funding from the activist hub. But he's now gone to America on a salary of $1 million.
Yeah. Does that answer your question as well?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Take a couple more. One here. Okay, one there.
I'm from Germany and I'm a German citizen, which perhaps you could say is one of the more equal countries. Mm-hmm. I guess that's part of your analysis. What I realize, and this also accounts for a lot of people that I know in central continental Europe, is that even though we realize that it's very stable and even fair, there's not much happening or going on. In fact, I know a lot of people that want to leave Germany because, especially when you look at innovation, that there's not much happening, that we don't have this dynamics which perhaps the US economy has.
Yeah.
Could you, I'm really impressed with your data, but do you think there's also a problem with equality?
Yeah. We haven't got any. Nowhere.
Take one more.
Okay.
You
sorry.
That.
I told you I can't remember.
All right. So innovation. Hang on to that.
Yeah.
And your question was.
And education. You did talk about education in your book, Inequality 1%.
Yeah.
You talk a lot about education, the way in which inequalities are reproduced through education. and I wondered if you could make any educational policy suggestions, what would they be?
Okay. Difficult questions, I'll try. It's certainly true that more equality is a bit boring, particularly boring for the young. So not for kids, not for little kids, it's fine. It's when you are going out in the world, 18, 19, 20, want to prove yourself and want to do something. London is highly, highly attractive. It's not just the English language. It's the idea the streets are paved with gold. You can start up your internet startup company. You know, it'll be great. It'll all work. And luckily, you've got the foolishness of youth not to do any numbers and check your chances. But we certainly draw people in. And I can see there is a problem with that. It doesn't actually translate into more entrepreneurialism. Mm. So the country with the highest number of patents per person is Japan. Right? Not a place you might think of as being particularly inventive and so on. The US and UK tell themselves a myth about how inventive we are. But we even had to steal a French word. That's what entrepreneurialism is for it. You've only got to think, you know, what are our great inventions? Right, the great invention doesn't take you very long. It's the vacuum cleaner. Right, we invented a special kind of vacuum cleaner, which we now manufacture in the Far East. The number of patents and inventions per head in the more unequal countries is actually lower. The number of scientific papers written per head is highest in Scandinavia. But the bright lights look exciting. Equality, a bit greater equality, looks dull. If I worked in a Japanese university or in Germany, researchers in Germany know what salary they're going to get. The salary scales and the academic scales are there, they're published, you just get that. Whereas if you're a great, innovating, brilliant, young, thrusting academic and you want to make up, you think, come to Britain. And you think of yourself as the winner. Nobody thinks of themselves as loser. So people like the idea of grammar schools because they are going to do better in the grammar school. You don't think of yourself as the three quarters or four fifths of children are going to have to go to secondary modern. But most people who try and start up these firms, 99% of the startups, the ones who get to the point of registering for VAT, are dead within 10 years. Your chance of making it 10 years is 1% as a young innovator. And it doesn't even produce better innovation. So there's a case recently of somebody whose company is worth £1 billion now, who said he could start it up because he was in Sweden and he could afford to take the risks he actually needed to do and carry on going because he could live on benefits while he was inventing his particular app. On education, we've got a real problem. We're incredibly divided. Most of the division is actually within the state sector, which is people paying £200,000 or £300,000 more to be in the catchment of some schools rather than other schools. So I think we need to recognise across the board we have a problem. The city I live in now, Oxford, is twinned with the city of Bonn. Oxford, I think, has the widest educational inequalities of any city in Europe. We have one of the 25 worst performing schools in the country, where almost no children, I think it's about two a year, go to university, and some of the most expensive private schools in the country. People will pay £100,000 a time to move between the catchments of the five state schools before they then go and impoverish themselves for the third of our children who go to the private schools. It's terrible. Whereas if you go to Bonn, our twin city in Germany, it's quite hard to rank the schools in Bonn. They all produce better results. There is one famous private school in Bonn. It's not famous for being good, you know, so on. It's famous for taking the very, very slow children of the extremely rich. And their most famous alumni is Prince Philip. If we could get to that point, you know, me and Kate disagree on this. I wouldn't abolish private or public schools. I'd like to get to the point where it was...
I'm
more of a hippie.
Right.
We have the lowest state spending. I would reduce spending on arms, increase spending on education, and get it to the point where it is a really stupid thing to spend sending your child privately. It almost is like that already. So when I was growing up, it would make some sense to send your child privately because there's less than 10% of people at university. You dramatically increase their chances of going to university. Now that 50% of all young women go to university, what are you spending your money on? What is it getting you? And we've looked at a cohort in Bristol, all the children born in 1 year in Bristol. We've looked at all the children who score top in tests of ability at age 8, in the top 10th at age 8. And remarkably, I lost a pint of beer on this bet because I didn't believe it would be true. If you're in the top 10th at age 8, it made no difference what school you went to in Bristol. So what are the private schools doing in Bristol? They're dragging slow children up to get them A-levels, to get them into university. They're not actually helping the children. The rhetoric you always hear from parents is, my little Jimmy was ever so bright, so I would have been a crime not to, you know, help his potential. So we're somewhere along there already. But we're spending less than £2,000 a year per kid in our sixth forms now. Our sixth forms have had a 20% pay cut in the last couple of years, sorry, funding cut. FE colleges are falling apart. It's just criminal and it's very, very low.
Yeah. Okay, we mentioned a high proportion of women going to university. We've not heard from any women in the audience yet, but I'd like to. Any of you like to ask a question? One and two, and then I'll come to you.
Yeah.
Striped top? No?
Oh, no.
No, you were at the auction where you didn't win. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
One of the popular and sort of widely known explanations of why there is such a high degree of equality in Scandinavia is that they have very ethnically homogeneous communities, and that results in a sense of community. But in the current world, as the labour mobility increases already within Europe, and it's very difficult to construct sustainable bases for welfare states, is it even possible to... How should we change those structures so that we could redistribute more, find the basis for funding?
So I've spoken to students who I would say their family is in the 1%, and often their political views that I've noticed seem to lean quite heavily towards the left, and I've even heard some of them call it champagne socialism. Do you think that those views by young people in those families, do you think that would have any effect on reducing inequality?
That's tricky. I'll do yours first, so that's trickier. This is the idea that it's hard in countries which are less homogeneous, like the United States and the UK, to get support for equality as opposed to these countries where everybody is like each other already. When you get greater equality, people begin to think they're like each other, so racial differences reduce. So in Japan, people did used to think of there being lots of different ethnic and racial groups, and you shouldn't marry each other. And now there's a myth in Japan of a common Japanese genome that you all come from. Neither of these things are true. But you can't sustain group differences without economic differences. People will just mix if they're living in with similar levels of income going to the same schools. They'll even mix without that. So London has incredible rates of mixing between ethnic groups. Because no minority in London is more than 2%. So if you are in a minority in London, and that's a third to half of Londoners in much of London, the amount of self-control it takes to decide you're not interested in them, you're not interested in them, you're going to find somebody else who looks like your mum and dad, is just too much, which is interesting over social mixing. But it's our groups exist because of the economic inequality. The US is the easiest example of this. Just giving slaves freedom but no wealth doesn't make a set of people equal. So it's the economic inequality between the great-grandchildren of slaves and the great-grandchildren of slave owners that maintains the racial divisions. They disappear elsewhere. We are going to have to do something about Europe because we are going to have more and more moving around within Europe. We could decide that we're going to shut the borders and vote in that referendum, and that's going to be really interesting. If we do that, I mean, if you were trying to cause a crash in the British housing market and probably the banking system, but I wouldn't recommend this, but you know, if we did actually vote to leave, think of the repercussions of suddenly we're going to say that people can't come in, we're also going to say and have debated publicly for several months how much we dislike people like you, you know, coming here. We only want you if we do a test. Why are you coming here now? We want you to come later on in life when we can prove you're economically beneficial to the country. It's going to get very, very nasty while we have this debate. And then Scotland is going to decide it wants to stay in the EU and go off of its oil. And then we've got this tiny little currency called sterling that we think is safe. And none of you are old enough to remember the last time somebody had a play with sterling. It's called George Soros. And that's going to happen. The attitudes of the children of the 1%. That there isn't much. It's interesting. I think the majority are naturally conservative and fit what their parents fit. However, at the last election, a think tank polled students in different universities. I've forgotten the result, probably goodly for York. Oxford, Cambridge and Bristol, Labour. Majority Labour, quite stunning. In 1997, I did my own poll of Bristol because I was working in Bristol. And we had students outside the polling station, which was in Wheels Hall, which is a bit telling, is the poshest hall in Bristol. Bristol in 1997 in the student hall was the only place in the country which was majority Tory voting in 97, and it's quite a posh university. So there has been a kind of shift, and it's not impossible to imagine that it is a generation who may be thinking that their parents' generation have had views that were a bit obnoxious and did get it wrong. This happened before in the 1930s. Young people, mainly young men, because young women were not listened to and were trying to get the vote, but we'll get the vote at least at the age of 18. Young men in the 1930s began to form a view, 35, 36, 37, that their parents had got it terribly, terribly wrong. There'd been an economic crash in 1929, and then they began to realise that they were going to have to go to war, despite the fact their parents had gone to war. And that generation then became the generation in the 40s and 50s and eventually the Prime Minister in 1964 who made us much more equal. So if we get that again, then there is great hope for optimism. But the alternative is people in that group thinking it is all unfair and horrible and so on, but I need to get myself one of those safe jobs. And I need to make sure that I get a girlfriend or a boyfriend who's also from the same background as me, because it's going to get really tricky when we try and buy a flat if I'm the only one with a deposit. And that's my worry, is that there's two ways you can go. You can want to change the world, or you can want to fit in with it. And fitting in can appear to be a bit easier than changing it.
Well, maybe that's my problem, because I want to change the world, but I want to fit in as well.
Yeah.
I think we've probably reached time when we should draw this to a close.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Could we have Kate and Dan a very warm round of applause?